Welcome to the Bete Bora podcast. Bete Bora is a European network of Jewish women. We offer a platform for international exchange of feminist ideas. We talk with Jewish women about their aims, their activities, and their achievements. With this, we want to make women more visible and strengthen their position in society in general and in the Jewish world.
Hello and welcome to our podcast. I am here today to interview and talk with Alexandra Reichnina, or Sasha as she is known, and she's going to tell us more about how she planned and executed the Brindabar Arts Festival, which takes place in January, although with previews in the month or two before that, here in Newcastle upon Tyne. Just to let you know a little bit about Brindabar itself, it was launched in January 2016, and it's the first annual festival in the whole of the UK about the music and arts of the Holocaust. It takes its name from Hans Krause's children's opera Brindabar, which was performed publicly for the first times in Theresienstadt by the children in 1943. There are actually some videos of a couple of the children who performed in that opera who survived the Holocaust. And according to their own words, Brindabar Arts Festival seeks to find new ways positively to document these amazing achievements of these artists who composed and created under such terrible adversity and to keep alive their stories. So, Sasha, welcome, and thank you for agreeing to meet with me today. First of all, could you tell us a little about yourself and your, you know, particularly your musical training and the like before we get up to Newcastle?
Yeah, absolutely. But first, it's lovely to be speaking to you today. Thanks for thinking of me for this interview. About my background, I am originally from Russia. From Moscow, to be precise. And my family immigrated from Russia in 1990 when I was about seven.
I was going to ask if you'd done any training, musical training in Russia before you left.
Yes, I did. I started playing the violin at the time when I was probably six, seven, before we immigrated. But I don't think that was the time when I fell in love with the violin yet. What did it for me was that we had a very tough immigration and my parents were very young and, you know, they moved to a new country without speaking the language, without having jobs. And, you know, it was a tough time for the family. And of course, the last thing they had on their mind is, oh, find a violin teacher for Sasha, because they were trying to just make the ends meet, you know. Yeah. And that's actually, I think, what sort of how I realized that I wanted to be a violinist, because, you know, when this thing that you take for granted is taken away from you, that's when I really missed it. Yeah, weirdly. So all I could think about, even though I hated practicing when I was little, when we were still in Moscow, and it was a real, you know, effort, and my teacher was always angry with me for not practicing enough. Yeah, so when we moved to Belgium, all I could think about is the violin. And eventually I moaned long enough that my parents thought, okay, well, we have to do something about it. And they did find me a violin teacher. By then I was, I think, about nine. Yeah, so that's when I started playing the violin again.
Very seriously. And when did you decide you wanted to do violin as your profession as opposed to just a...
Right then. I was about nine. Yeah. I really knew that that's what I wanted to do. Yeah, and then, of course, the violin took me on many travels through my professional career. But I think then that's how I ended up in the UK, because I auditioned to the Yehudi Menuhin School when I was about 14. Oh. And I got into the school, and that's how I ended up in the UK, because it was a boarding school. So that's when basically I moved to the UK. I never kind of moved back to Belgium, really.
What brought you up to Newcastle? And for those of our listeners who don't know where Newcastle upon Tyne is, it's in the northeast of England, about 99 miles south of Edinburgh, on the coast in the forest. It's a lovely place. So what brought you up here to Newcastle from London?
Yeah, so I when I finished Menuhin School, I went to the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, where I did my BMus and MMus, and then when I was still actually finishing music college, I started looking for jobs and I auditioned to the Royal Northern Sinfonia, which is based in Newcastle. And I don't think I'd even ever heard of Newcastle until I just auditioned for the job. And I got a trial, and I started my trial, I think, in September. And by December, I'd got the job. So, yeah, that's how I ended up.
When was that? When did you first come up here?
That was 2008, I think, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, at some point, now I got to know lecturer at Newcastle University named Dr. Ian Biddle, who taught a course which I ended up being a part of, eventually teaching part of, called Holocaust in Music. And because I was listening to somebody sing, and they were wonderful, and they said, well, they'd learned a bit of Yiddish from this. Well, it's not a lecture at the university. And I met you too about the same time, because he gave a lecture at this festival you did. So what first of all, can you tell us what was the impetus for you to get involved at all in doing music for Holocaust Memorial Day? And when was this? You know, what brought that up altogether?
So at one point in my life in Newcastle, I was asked to perform at Holocaust Memorial Day. As you may know, in Newcastle, they mark Holocaust Memorial Day every year, and it's been a tradition for God knows how many years, but they're quite serious about it there. And so this one particular year, I am not 100% sure when it was. I think it was either 2012 or 2013, maybe 2013. They asked me to play. And I thought, oh, wow, of course, I would love to do that. It's a very meaningful thing for me to do. And I just thought, well, what am I going to play? And I basically just did a little bit of research. It was quite a superficial research. I wanted to play something relevant to the subject. I just didn't think, oh, playing like solo Bach or something random. I didn't think that was not appropriate, but I wanted it to be meaningful to the event. And so I started doing a little bit research, and that's when I came across this vast amount of what I call treasure, because that was what it was to me, this incredible music that I had never heard of. And I actually found it quite hurtful and painful to discover all this music that I, as a musician, as a Jewish musician, had never heard of before. And I thought, my God, that's crazy. And I think that's maybe when the seed of the festival was planted in my mind. I remember even talking to my mom and saying, one day I'd love to dedicate a whole festival to this music. And that's basically how the idea came.
Wow. Did you have any kind of family, a personal family or a near family experiences of Holocaust?
Not of Holocaust, no. I mean, my family comes from Eastern Europe, so Russia and Ukraine, Belarus. So obviously other kinds of persecution, but not the Holocaust specifically.
Yeah, okay. When you first came upon this music, which was, who was your first choice for that particular Holocaust Memorial Day commemoration? Who did you first choose to play?
It's a good question. I think I actually ended up, I didn't have many resources, as in, it was just me. And obviously with the repertoire, it's quite specific, orchestrations, limitations. And so I think at the time I actually ended up playing a piece by a composer who wasn't Jewish, but who sort of, you know, was voiced loudly his, you know, how against what, you know, what was happening, he was, and it was Hartman. Uh-huh. And I found some Hartman solo, I mean, basically it was just me, so it was solo violin stuff. Yeah, so it was, I think, Hartman Sonata or something like that, and I just had to play one little movement of it. But apart, I mean, that was just like on the side from all the stuff that I found. And it was, I didn't find specifically works for the violin, I just found loads and loads of music.
Found all this other music, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's interesting, because I first encountered that music and the idea of Entartete music, you know, degenerate music, at an exhibition in on the South Bank in London decades ago. But of course, and they had sound things up, but they were all broken. So I couldn't actually listen at that point, but I started to hear a little bit of it. But, you know, it wasn't mainstream music. It wasn't, you know, played in general. So, you know, what was it as a Jew that made you decide, well, this might be something that you wanted to make into a festival? I mean, how did it progress from there to you doing a piece to, you know, this wonderful program we have up here?
I guess, I mean, it took a lot of courage, and I couldn't do it all completely on my own. Oh. So I had to find some allies, so to speak. I asked two of my friends who I thought could be helpful, and who, you know, so both girls, we started it off with two people who were at the time, Yoshi Kawamura, who is based in Newcastle and who we actually went to Guildhall together. She's a pianist, and she just finished a course at Northumbria University on, I can't remember exactly what the course is called, but it was to do with organizing musical events, and she was thinking of organizing master classes and things like that.
Very useful.
Yeah, exactly. So she just finished this course, and I thought, oh, this is amazing, because then, you know, this would be the perfect thing to do after finishing a course like that. She seemed really keen, and that's how she ended up kind of entangled in this project. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, I forgot the...
The question really is, how did you go from that one little kernel to beginning a festival where you were playing the music? How did you, and you know, move to that?
I mean, technically speaking, it was quite a complicated procedure, because we had to, you know, organize. First of all, it has to be a charity organization, it has to be a company, we had to set up all of these things. So it was quite difficult at first. And the second person I asked, Juliet Lee, she's based in London, actually, and she's a violinist as well, but she at the time took a little bit of time away from the violin and worked in a management company, a music management company, so she also had a bit of skills outside just playing. And her father happens to be a lawyer. So, I mean, I hadn't planned it that way, but actually he was extremely helpful in helping us set up the official aspect of the festival. So,
you decided after playing this one piece and finding all this music that it needed to be something more?
It took a few years. I mean, like, I would say 2-3 years until this little seed of an idea actually concretized into the festival.
Did the council up here support it, or did they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah, like, right from the first year. And, I mean, in a way, what I find with this festival quite often is, I don't know whether, because it would generally interest people who are very special or what, but it just, every time I would be looking for something, or I would be, you know, it's like a puzzle, things just would fit in together, and you would find the right person and the right, and so when we approached the council, it just happened that year they their whole process of organizing Holocaust Memorial Day changed. They were looking for organizations And they had a certain amount of funding, and they were specifically looking for people who wanted to organize a Holocaust Memorial Day event. And we stepped that day in their office and said, "Hi, do you have any money?" So that was actually the first people who funded a little bit. I mean, we're not talking huge money, but just a little bit of money.
And gave you, also helped you find a way to do this, you know, is it to make it more?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously being in the profession, I'm in the right place for finding musicians, for finding venues, because I'm playing in them all the time. Yeah. So that's the part I enjoy the most, you know, programming, researching. I mean, that's actually a major part, but I love doing that. That's my sort of favorite aspect of the festival is, you know, once the festival is over and I'm sort of finished with all the administrative aspect, which isn't my favorite part, I get onto programming very quickly because there is always deadlines to you know, for funding again. And until I've sort of programmed the next year, I can't rest and I can't breathe really. I have to have the next program set up so that I can then breathe and go, okay, now I can breathe and relax for a bit until we start fundraising again.
You called the festival the Brundibar Festival. Could you tell us a little bit what is Brundibar and why you called it the Brundibar Festival?
Oh yeah, actually that's a good point. When I got my team and when we started, you know, thinking about all the official aspects, we had to find a name. And I, again, just through research and reading about things, I came across the story of Brundibar the opera, which some of you may be familiar with. But it was an opera written by Hans Kresser, who ended up incarcerated in Theresienstadt. And the score that he had written before he ended up there was smuggled into the camp, and he rearranged it for a smaller orchestration for the instruments that were at the time available in the camp. And they then performed it. And so it's a children's opera, that's the main thing. Yeah. It's unusually a children's opera. It was then performed 55 times by the children who were incarcerated in Theresienstadt. I mean, it's a very symbolic and moving story to me. And I guess it was a kind of a dedication. I mean, the whole festival is a dedication to the artists who suffered and perished, or whose lives were, you know, thrown upside down. And so I felt that that was the right, it felt right. Really right away that was the right name for it.
It's interesting because when I was doing the lecturing in this course of Ian Biddle's, I taught the Theresien, although it wasn't a Yiddish center as all the others were, I did the Theresien unit, because you can't talk about Holocaust and music without at least mentioning Theresien.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah.
And I found YouTubes. There were a couple of children from Brundibar who'd played in the, who'd survived and were actually able to talk about it. So it's moving. You got to stage Brundibar, the actual children's opera. Was it 3 years ago or 2 years ago? Up here?
It was 2 years ago. Yeah, I mean, actually, it was a long-term dream of ours. And we started the whole festival with the idea that we were going to launch this festival and have the opera. But that was actually very ambitious. Yes. That was the inexperience, you know, to set up the whole charity company, get the funding, organize a festival, and by the way, raise like £40,000 and get an offer. You know, that was not really going to happen in the first year. So, but then every year after that, we sort of said, oh, let's do it next year, or let's do it next year. And then there was always something, well, a reason why it couldn't go ahead, and eventually it did. And again, it was when it was supposed to happen. You know, I just trust these little coincidences somehow. It was actually Opera North company that contacted me first.
Oh, I see.
They approached me first. Yeah, they said, oh, would you be interested in putting the opera on, and I was like, yeah. So that's yeah, and then it happened eventually, but then actually first COVID happened, so that was one reason why it didn't happen in whenever it was 2020, I think. Yeah. It was supposed to happen, but it did happen in 2021. That's it.
Right, 2021. So that was when it was. So mm-hmm. I was struck by the fact that the first conference, there were these composers. Some of them survived the camps and some didn't. That's the way it was. But all of their music was proscribed in Nazi Germany. So you had also, I think Mozart and whatever. What was your philosophy? Why mm-hmm. didn't you just play mm-hmm. these mm-hmm. various composers whose names you should mention?
Yes. What did you mean by conference? Sorry.
Concert. It wasn't just Schulhoff, Goldschmidt, Ullmann, Krennic. What was your philosophy about that?
Yeah, well, the festival has a specific shape, actually, which I try to stick to because I think it works. So there is an opening event, usually an opening concert. Then there is a middle event, which is quite often like different, something slightly unusual or different, like a mixed arts. So poetry and music or opera or theater. We've done loads of theater. We've done, exhibitions and a film premiere, etc., etc. So that's usually in the center of the festival. And then the festival ends with a closing concert. And so how it works is the opening concert is always just Holocaust composers. So it's fully dedicated to just those composers. And the closing concert is a mixture of mainstream and a repertoire and Holocaust composers. And the reason for that is, I guess at the time, I just wanted to juxtapose these pieces that I thought, like, I would choose the most amazing works that I really would fall in love with and program them in a more mainstream concert repertoire. And the idea was to prove to the audiences that these pieces are no less amazing and no less worth being performed, and that they should be programmed more often, and that's the simple thought behind it.
It's interesting because there are places where people have concerts of the similar kind of, Antarctica music, but they mm-hmm. they are I think there was somebody who did a series in at the South Bank in London, and there's I have a friend who's a pianist and now in America, and he had these concerts too. I'm sorry, I keep saying conference, and mm-hmm. but yeah, I don't tend to see them as part of a concert that might include a Beethoven symphony and
I just wanted to finish very quickly because it's an important part of the festival, since we're talking about it. Every festival always ends with a new commission, which is also slightly unusual. Right. And it is unusual because usually if you program a special commission, it's not going to be the last thing in a festival. We always commission a new piece, and the new piece is always the last piece in the program. And again, it's a symbolic thing. I've mentioned this before when I presented, but it's our way of continuing the work of those composers whose voices had been cut short. And it leaves like an open door for next year's festival.
Tell us a bit about some of the composers and what you particularly value about their work. Because I think the names should be, we haven't actually named them. Well, we've named them in passing, but tell me about mm-hmm. some of the composers, these Jewish composers who either perished, mm-hmm. whose music was,
Every festival usually has a theme. And I could talk about the next festival, maybe. I don't know.
Tell me about some of the composers' names and what you what you like about them. Then we can talk about the other. I just like to know, for instance, what.
Well, we could start with Krasa because that's after Brundibar was his piece, and a composer that I didn't know at all and gradually discovered, and I absolutely love his music. It's so quirky and genius and experimental in a subtle way, But yeah, so I've had quite a few of his works performed aside from the opera. Well, the two string trios, which both were written in Terezin, and one is an early piece, so at the start of his incarceration, and the second trio, which is actually the last piece he wrote. In fact, it was the last piece he ever wrote because he was deported to Auschwitz, where he perished. I think it's one of my most favorite pieces, which I actually performed myself. But it's so powerful. It's such an incredible music. It starts in a really sort of dark place, but it ends with so much hope and passion and kind of upward. It ends in, and it just feels like he knew somehow that it was his last piece. But yeah, I really, it's a very powerful piece of music if you ever get to hear it. But another one of my favorite composers is Schulhoff.
Yeah.
Just really quirky character. He actually ended up in a camp for like a war prisoner camp. So because he was a communist as well as the Jew, so there was a choice there as to
we'll get him for both. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think he died of typhus or something like that. He was just very experimental, and he wrote crazy stuff like. I can't remember the name of this piece, but it's basically a for solo soprano, and the piece consists of him of the female singer faking an orgasm all the way through the performance. But it's carefully
I don't remember seeing that one at the Brenda Barr Festival.
Well, I guess that was just to give you a shocking example of what the kind of stuff that he would do. But it's not just random, random faking. It's carefully written out.
Yeah.
One of the pieces I had performed is the Nightingale, which was written for counterbassoon. That's a funny one. I mean, as we know, counterbassoon is a really low instrument, and the Nightingale.
And it was amazing, the piece. Because
did you hear it? You there when? Yeah. So that was another quirky one of his. He's written for saxophone. There's definitely a lot of jazz influence in his music.
Because most of the music is that kind of mid 1900s type, and it has.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know.
What's been the reception? Because I know we're running out of time, and I just wanted how have people taken to the music?
Amazing, actually. I'm always surprised how far can I take it. Because a lot of people who come to the festival, that's the kind of brilliant thing about it. It attracts people who are into music and who aren't into music at all. But I think what really works with this festival is because that's the aim. These pieces tell a story, you know, and because of the story behind this music, it speaks to everybody, and people usually really understand. People don't come to the festival expecting to hear Mozart.
Yeah.
Or at least not much of it. Yeah. Yeah. So usually the reception is very warm.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've people that I've known in various amateur orchestras in which I play have come, have not heard the music before, and are, you know, some of it's just, and you've also, I mean, the wonderful thing, you've been able to attract, because of your sparkling personality and your connections as a musician, you've been able to get, renowned stars to come up here.
Brilliant artists.
You can sit next to, Natalie Chen, and listen to her play, it's been wonderful. So in the last couple minutes, just tell us, although you're now mostly based in Belgium, what are your plans for this coming Rundebar Festival?
So just to correct you very quickly, I'm based in the Netherlands now. What's for the upcoming festival? Did you want me to tell you a little bit about that?
Yeah, tell us a bit about what you've got planned. Yes. We should also tell people that this will be the place to be end of December, beginning of January. And by the way, she also, I'll just throw it in very quickly, you also do some educational piece. So you go to schools or work with an amateur orchestra. So there are, you know, and it's not just performances, but also getting involved. So
yeah, we also go to Jewish care home. We play in, every year. We perform for a Jewish care home, and yes, we do education stuff. And it is end of January, early February, around Holocaust Memorial Day.
But you also have concerts. You have preliminary concerts at the end of December, don't
yeah,
you?
In autumn we tend to, but they are not really part of the festival, they're just sort of introductory, because obviously a lot of the repertoire that we perform throughout the festival is unfamiliar, so we present not the same pieces but the same composers in autumn as a kind of preliminary introduction to the festival coming right every autumn. Yeah, but so next year is a Polish theme, so Polish Jewish composers, and that's a huge one. I did hours of research and reading about composers and listening, and you know, and obviously we all know there was such a huge Jewish population in Poland.
Yeah.
And I couldn't so you know, I told you about the shape of the festival, how there's this opening concert where I program only just the Holocaust composers, and I couldn't make it to, I couldn't resume it to just this one concert, because there were so many amazing pieces and so many amazing composers that I ended up with two opening concerts, so opening, so to speak. So yeah, that's what's going to happen. There's going to be two concerts to open the festival, and then there is going to be an opera. I was contacted by a young Jewish composer, Noah Max, absolutely brilliant guy. He is also a painter and a poet and a conductor, just putting it out there as well. And he's only like 20, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 maybe, but he wrote the opera when he was 23. And it's based on the book The Boy in the Striped Pyjama.
Can you say the name again?
The Boy in the Striped Pyjama.
Oh, The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, right.
Yeah, and he's written an opera based on the book, and it's very powerful. Yeah, it's quite a modern piece of music. But he sent me, it has already been performed. It was performed in London last year, and he sent me a video recording, and I watched it, and, you know, I was sort of blown away by it, particularly towards the end. And yeah, so I felt like it was really very fitting for our festival. So we're going to have that. We're planning two performances of it. And then the closing concert is going to be a very special concert, because So in my research, I was trying to find female composers, but for many reasons, there are not that many women, Jewish Polish women at that time that wrote. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. For known reasons to us. But yeah, but I did come across, and this is a very emotional part for me, this young girl, Josima Felczuk, who lived in Warsaw, and she was this wunderkind pianist, just incredibly talented, and she wanted to be a composer, and she it was really like she was so serious about it, and she was saying, you know, I see no reason why women can't be composers. And she was, you know, really little, so her first pieces are, you know, sort of age 9, and she wrote 17 pieces, and she died fleeing Warsaw, and her manuscript, music was conserved. Her father survived, and it is in Yad Vashem, and the actual, her handwritten, really neat, lovely handwritten book with these 17 piano pieces. And she so I was able to get a copy, so I have the copy of this notebook of hers. And so the concert, the closing concert, is going to be dedicated to her. Mm-hmm. And we are going to perform 4 of the 17 piano pieces amongst a program that I've designed, and the closing specially commissioned piece by a Ukrainian composer who is currently hiding in Poland is going to be dedicated to Josima.
Oh, that's wonderful. Very exciting. Thank you so much, Sasha.
Thank you, listeners, for your interest. Our next Bete Borg podcast will come out in a month. Goodbye and stay well.